kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me in my
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. No guest today, so I can share additional insights into progressive issues. Our program, for those of you who are just joining us, and we have anywhere from 4,000 to 6,000 to 7,000 brand new listeners every day, involves the latest on health and nutrition, always citing the peer-reviewed literature, showing that quality independent science shows you can live a longer and healthier life. I'll talk about drug-resistant cancers and how you can use natural supplements to overcome those limitations. Also talk about spirulina, one of those superfoods. Well, there's new research showing you how it can really impact your brain. Then the vegan diets, they can improve functioning in the body. I'll explain that. In our environmental segment today, I'll share the latest information on fracking and how all these different fracking areas are being opened up. How's that possible? From our public health segment, new research published in a major journal shows that the hepatitis B vaccine given within hours of birth is worthless. Also today, I want to do a commentary from Ralph Nader comparing the American healthcare system to the Canadian healthcare system, and why it's so much better, and why we should just scrap this Obamacare completely and do it right. But why we're not likely to do that, and in part that's because of the talking points and the ideologies espoused by so many people on the corporate left. Oh, and were you told that last week those individuals had a private meeting off the record with President Obama? Yes. MSNBC host Ed Schultz, Lawrence O'Donnell, the Washington Post economic blogger Ezra Klein, Mother Jones, Washington Bureau Chief David Korn, Talking Points memo editor and publisher Josh Marshall, Think Progress editor-in-chief Judd Legum, Atlantic senior editor Garance Ruda, Salam political writer Brian Butler, Fox News contributor Juan Williams, they and others met with the president. Why? If I was asked to have my entire staff and all of our producers from the Progressive Radio Network meet with the president, I would readily agree, providing that it was based upon our ability to ask questions upon his policies. I would find it reprehensible that we would be used as propaganda tools. I would never consent to that. And that's one of the reasons that I have been stating and will continue to state that those of you who have lived by conservative or liberal values, traditional values, you are so alienated from those who have corporatized the values and what we see now in the majority of the corporate media and politicians. They do not represent true conservative, true liberal values at all. MSNBC is just the fox on the other side. We'll deal with that. I'm going to begin a new part of our program today called Progressive Issues. That's because so many people, including on some stations, our sister stations, really represent the corporate liberal strategy. But real progressives seek out the truth, wherever it's at. So I'm going to talk about issues that impact all of us and that you almost never hear discussed. So we'll get to those, and I'll give you specific examples, and also we'll start with two commentaries on those. So you see, we have an awful lot to share today, including I'm going to ask if anyone can call in and let me know the author of a very short but very powerful commentary I'll be sharing with you in a little bit. And then call to action. That's also a part of what we do on a regular basis. I'm going to be sharing three bills, insights, why you should call and let your legislator know no to these House energy bills that would unleash fracking everywhere on public lands. Let's begin. There are a lot of people being treated for cancers. In fact, probably 98% using surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. A lot of that is resistant, and most people die, certainly of the more serious cancers. Now, a brand new study published in the peer-reviewed journal Molecular Cancer showed that there is a remarkable new mechanism using omega-3 fatty acids that can help with multi-drug-resistant cancers. The article is entitled, Omega-3 Fatty Acids Chemosensitize Multi-Drug-Resistant Colon Cancer Cells by Downregulating Cholesterol Synthesis and Altering Detergent Resistant Membrane Composition. Sounds like a very technical, uninteresting article. But it isn't, because at the heart of it is they tested the omega-3 fatty acids, the ones that we recommend you use all the time, and found that in both human colon cancer cells, sensitive and resistant to multiple conventional chemotherapy agents, it allowed greater progress to be made in fighting the cancer. Now, there's a situation where you have conventional medicine and alternative healing combined together. We've also seen this works with vitamin C as well. It is not for me to tell people not to get chemotherapy or radiation or just to do alternative, but rather to look at the evidence. And on the one hand, we have your doctor saying, well, only rely upon evidence-based science to guide you in your medicine. And if that were the case, 90% of all medical procedures currently used would not be allowed to be used, because they just don't have science on their side. I remember the first time I saw someone promoting spirulina, and it was back in 1977. And I got a call from Dick Gregory. And Dick says, what do you know about this spirulina stuff? And I said, well, it's an algae. It's a single cell algae. It's very, very high in its protein, higher than meat or eggs. In fact, higher than any food. But you would have to use it with something else, because even though it has a complete protein, it's very limited in some of the amino acids. And he said, well, what would you use it with? I said, well, you could use it with beans or grains. And he said, well, but how would you do that? I said, well, just get some brown rice powder, protein powder, or split pea powder, and mix it together. Then you've got a really powerful protein drink. At that time, most of the spirulina was being grown down in a lake in Mexico. Now we know a lot more about it. There are thousands of articles on spirulina. This is the latest, as reported by Elizabeth Rentner, Natural Society, quote, used medicinally for centuries, spirulina is said to be one of the oldest forms of life on Earth, eaten since at least the 9th century in the Kenem Empire of Chad in Africa. Yeah, that's correct. Well, we know it's loaded with good nutrition. It's great for children. And in fact, it's one of the things we should be using all over the world for helping malnourished people. Recently, at one of our retreats to help this, our sister station, WBAI, a woman introduced herself, and she had been a high-ranking member of the United Nations. And she remembers when I did the Egg Project, this is 25 years ago, and she came to that all-day lecture where I laid out all the background, because it was really very provocative. In effect, what I was saying was that we no longer had to have any animal proteins at all in our diet, no dairy or cheeses or beef, pork, fish, in order chicken to get all of our amino acids. Yet all the textbooks claimed, including my dietetics textbook and my nutrition textbook, that you had to have animal proteins 3 times a day, or you would become anemic, you'd lose your muscle mass. And the research that I'd done at the Institute of Applied Biology proved just the opposite, that you could have protein, all 8 essential amino acids, the same amino acids you get in a hamburger or a steak or fish, you can get in a bowl of brown rice or some black beans or everything. It was just how you combine them. And it took about 2 years to figure out how to combine them all to get, in a normal serving size, more protein utilization than from any animal protein. In fact, we came up with 5,000 combinations that were greater than any animal protein. And that's what that whole day seminar was about, how you can get your protein. And this woman at the time came over and said that she worked in a program helping malnourished people in Africa, and wouldn't it make sense to send them these powders or have them? I said, no, it would make far more sense to provide them with heirloom seeds for the grains and legumes they could grow in Africa so they could build up their own local agriculture. And that would be a better way. Why? Because most of the food that we give them in these food subsidy programs is terrible. We give them millions of pounds of non-fat dry milk. What's the problem? Well, you give a woman who's nursing non-fat dry milk, if she has a lactose intolerance, she could end up with diarrhea, her baby could end up dying. So not good, because the water that you give to hydrate those non-fat dry milks is more often than not polluted, in which case then if she's not nursing or too weak to nurse or too malnourished nurse, then she's going to kill her baby with contaminated water, which is very common. You would think that we'd be putting wells in every place in Africa where there are people who need the clean water, filtered clean water, without natural arsenic or other background minerals that could hurt them. That we could do in all of Africa. I actually did the math on this. It was 27,000 places we could build a deep well, anywhere from a few hundred feet to over 2,000 feet, where at least people have water for human use, even irrigation. But instead, you could then grow legumes and beans, which are very easy to grow, require very little water. And I said that the one thing you can add would be spirulina. Because if you had a spirulina powder that you added to anything, you suddenly give it a super boost in protein. And she said that stuck with her. Anyhow, that all came back after all those years. So here we have spirulina. And there are more than 40,000 varieties of spirulina. Most of it's harvested and cultivated in fresh water. There's only 4 calories per gram. Here's the latest from a major study published in a major scientific publication, Scientia Publica. Children with an average age of 7 years were given 2 grams of spirulina daily for 2 months. Their academic performance was compared with other children. On average, they saw an increase in academic performance using spirulina. Well, how could that happen? How could this simple little algae powder improve cognitive ability, overall brain health, and mental health? Well, one study compared the antioxidants like that you find in spirulina, spinach, and blueberries, and they all were neuroprotective, but spirulina had the highest neuroprotective effect. It protects your brain, all ages, everyone, every human being uses it, it's neuroprotective. Why? Because it can turn off inflammation everywhere in the body. So that would help you with arthritis, bursitis, diabetes, cancer, prostate inflammation, breast cancer, and any form of brain condition. Another study found that spirulina can protect the brain from damage and generation disease like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. And yet another study concludes, quote, these results support the hypothesis that a diet enriched with spirulina and other nutraceuticals may help protect the stem progenitor cells from insults, end quote. Well, and one last thing here. Overall health is related to brain performance. So by boosting the children's overall health profile, the spirulina could increase their academic potential. It's 70% protein by weight. That's higher than soy. It's rich in vitamins A, C, D, and E, and B complex. But it also is rich in vitamin B12, which is not typically found in vegetable sources. And it contains a wide variety of minerals and antioxidants and fatty acids that can help your skin, your hair, and fight cell damage. So it's just one of the things we should be using more often that we're not, that we could benefit from. And by the way, I'm willing to do this study. If we can find a village, can't be that big, but a village of maybe up to 1,000 people in Africa where the government would allow or the authorities would allow this, on my dime, I will pay for it all. I will go over and I will show them and give them the tools to be 100% self-sufficient in food. The kind of hydroponic house to build, dig them a well, seed propagation, how to create their own seed bank, and how to overcome nutritional deficiencies, how to protect against natural occurring infections and disease. And then to compare that with maybe 10 other villages the same size or approximate same size within a certain given period of time for 1 year. And then if you can see that these people are healthier, their children are healthier, there's less diseases and infections, they become self-sufficient and improve the quality of their life, then possibly we could then encourage foundations and other people or governments or the UN to use that as a model to help. So since we have people from the UN listening right now, including some top people who listen every day, I know that for a fact because I know these people. Consider that. Okay, that's an offer I'm putting out there. Also, for the good people of Detroit who've taken such a beating and who've been victimized so terribly, if you could get the city and your council to give one block, one square block, I'd be willing to go into Detroit on my dime, not a penny from anyone, but rehabilitate it to show how you can do it. I believe that it is a disservice to the citizens of America that we have allowed so many areas to become ghettoized and the people to suffer and then blame the consequences of those who suffer and then act out as if somehow it's their fault and show them how you can rejuvenate and rehabilitate using just the people there, no outside people. Everything that would be done locally, but how you do it. And if we can take one block to make it an oasis and show how to make a city revive from the ground up using the local people and improve the quality of their life, the system itself, then why not say, all right, now let's do the block across the street or the block ahead. You've got to have an example of something before other people see it's possible. And I believe it's definitely possible. In any case, a lot of us know that wheat is not good for us because of the gluten. This is the latest from Sleuth Journal. Wheat may promote diabetes through disturbing gut flora. Quote, while it is not commonly understood as a concept that wheat or gluten can cause blood sugar disorders, and certainly not as serious as type 1 diabetes, which involves the autoimmune destruction of the insulin-producing beta cells in the pancreas, a sizable body of animal and human data points to exactly this causal link. Okay, why? Anyone who's ever listened to this program knows that gluten, after all, is well known for adversely affecting gut health, gas, constipation, bloating, malabsorption syndrome, triggering autoimmune reactions, swelling of the hands, swelling of the feet, puffiness of the eyes, mucus. You see how it works. It's like a virtual Pandora's box. And that can then trigger intestinal permeability, what we call leaky gut. And also, the new research shows that up to 23,000 unique digestive-resistant polypeptides, which are capable of infiltrating the body, causing systemic inflammation and the loss of immunological self-tolerance, meaning the ability to distinguish between self and non-self. As a result, every time you eat wheat, according to this peer-reviewed PLOS One article, you end up causing autoimmune reaction. The Mayo Clinic researchers sought to elucidate the mechanisms at play within this observed link in both animal and human studies, and were able to do so. And I read the article, and it shows this. So when we're suggesting go on a gluten-free diet, it would be good for everyone, especially those who have diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and especially our children. I'll be addressing later this week the statements by the American Cancer Society that there is no link between sugar and cancer. My hope is that after presenting this on the air, plus providing the information in writing in an article with all the scientific abstracts from peer-reviewed journals, that they will change their misinformation. My hope is that people in the audience will send this over to the American Cancer Society when it's published and broadcast later this week, so at least those people who have cancer understand why they really should be on a sugar-free diet. This is the latest on a review finds diet soda to be a health destroyer. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Endocrinology and Metabolism as reported by Elizabeth Rentner, Natural Society. Quote, "It is hardly surprising to learn that diet soda is dangerous or that it may do more harm than good. We've been reporting on the dangers of diet soda here for a long time. Well, recently, researchers from Purdue University reviewed a dozen studies, all published within the last 5 years, on the health risk of consuming diet soda. They published their findings in Trends in Endocrinology and Metabolism, and it was a shock. Quote, honestly, this is from the study, I thought that diet soda would be marginally better compared to regular soda in terms of health, said Dr. Susan Swithers, but in reality it has a counterintuitive effect. We've gotten to a place where it is normal to drink diet soda because people have the false impression that it is a healthier soda than indulging in regular soda. But research is now very clear that we need to also be mindful of how much fake sugar we're consuming." End quote. And then it concludes, quote, "The negative impact of consuming sugar-sweetened beverages on weight and other health outcomes has been increasingly recognized. Therefore, many people have turned to highly intense sweeteners like aspartame, sucralose, and saccharin as a way to reduce the risk of these consequences. However, accumulating evidence suggests that frequent consumers of these sugar substitutes may also be at an increased risk of excessive weight gain, metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular disease." End quote. So, there's another article in the journal, Clinical Journal of American Society of Nephrology, found a strong positive correlation between degeneration of kidney function and consumption of aspartame-containing diet soda. And finally, there is a study that eating nuts may prolong your life. This is from Harvard School of Public Health, as published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's the largest study ever done of its kind, and it shows what we've been talking about for decades. Eat a handful of nuts every day and live a longer life than those who do not. Scientists in the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Brigham and Women's Hospital and the Harvard School of Public Health looked at 120,000 people over 30 years, and they looked at everything that they were eating, and they found that this is what they said from a Dr. Fuchs about nuts. Quote, "The most obvious benefit are a reduction of 29% in deaths from heart disease, the major killer of people in America. But we also saw a significant reduction in the risk of dying from cancer." End quote. How about that? Pine nuts, pistachios, macadamias, walnuts, almonds. Yeah, eat these nuts and live a longer life. And from the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, as published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients, they found that vegan diets protect, quote, against hypothyroidism. They looked at 65,000 men and women and looked at their diets and find out that those who were vegan had the least amount of hypothyroidism. So for a healthier thyroid, eat a healthy vegan diet. It is also protective for cardiac, nerve, gastrointestinal, and psychologic functioning. So, all good if you are into eating a vegan diet. Now, let's see from our commentary segment today if you can tell me who this author is, because this is something that impacts all of us today. This is entitled The Land of the Docile and Unfree. The American of today, in fact, probably enjoys less personal liberty than at any other time, and even his political liberty is fast succumbing to the new dogma that certain theories of government are virtuous and lawful, and others abhorrent and felonious. Laws limiting the radius of his free activity multiply year by year. It is now practically impossible for him to exhibit anything describable as genuine individuality, either in action or thought, without running afoul of some harsh or unintelligible penalty. Nor would it astound any, save the most romantic, if at the same time the goddess of liberty were taken off the silver dollar to make room for a base relief of a policeman. Moreover, this gradual and of late rapidly progressive decay of freedom goes almost without challenge. The American has grown so accustomed to the denial of his constitutional rights and to the minute regulation of his conduct by swarms of spies, agent provocateurs, informers, that he no longer makes any serious protest. It is surely a significant fact that in the face of the late almost incredible proceedings under the so-called Espionage Act and other such laws that still exist, the only objections heard came from either the persons directly affected or no one. The American people as a people acquiesced docilely in all these tyrannies. End quote. Who's the author? Give us a call, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Like, see if you know who that is. Now to what concerns me. And also Carl Gibson, reader-supported news. The Hunger Games are real. We are the districts. For those in this audience who heard a commentary I wrote and presented about a year ago about the Hunger Games, and I said, how could we find it abhorrent, which we should, to read about child-on-child violence and people texting or sending videos of people getting beatdowns, and then at the same time not be equally horrified when we see a movie that becomes an international blockbuster where it's the entertainment of the rich and powerful and overcome the boredom of those who are not, that they put child on child to hunt and kill each other in grotesque and unique ways. And what happens when we accept that as being normal? Well, now, of course, the second Hunger Games has just premiered, and it's a monster box office hit, and there'll be a whole sequel, a series to this. It's a franchise. The few rich men who control the capital have successfully managed to consolidate the majority of the nation's wealth into their hands. The capital has taken away food stamps from hungry families and given it to their rich beneficiaries in the form of tax breaks and subsidies and other forms of corporate welfare. Career politicians are even smashing up the possessions of homeless people with a sledgehammer with impunity while wearing designer clothes. These rich men also control the news, all the news that is broadcast over the airwaves that brainwashes the impoverished masses into believing their suffering is their own fault, that they're only starving because they don't know how to work hard, and that those who control all the resources must somehow deserve it because their status makes them more worthy. However, the rich men still aren't satisfied. They're already trying to force through a trade deal, secret from the public, that would subvert what remains of democracy and install global corporate rule. When the poor and oppressed dare to speak out against the injustices of the ruling class, Washington's peacekeeping forces suppress their protests with extraordinary brutality. When the people try to vote out their corrupt leaders in the electoral process, the ruling class simply drowns out the democratic process by dumping truckloads of money into incumbents' pockets. Meanwhile, the impoverished masses are constantly told, be thankful for your freedom. And they're given mindless distractions to keep their minds off what their real problems are. Now, I'm not talking about the Hunger Games now. I'm talking about the present-day life in the United States. That Parisha Macy, a student at Bryant Elementary School in Philadelphia, died from an asthma attack, caused as a result of Pennsylvania's governor Tom Corbett's class war. Since 2010, Corbett has given out $2 billion in corporate tax breaks while cutting public schools by over $1 billion. As a result, schools like Bryant Elementary have had to cut budgets, meaning school nurses are only present on certain days. Unfortunately for her, Massey suffered an asthma attack on the day the nurse wasn't in, couldn't get medical attention until the end of the school day, and died as a result. Meanwhile, corporations like those given massive tax breaks by the Corbett administration are enjoying record profits on Wall Street and not doing a thing about jobs. Instead of creating jobs, these companies are using these tax breaks to buy back stock, their own stock, like Walmart does, to the tune last year, what was it, $7.6 billion? Well, what would happen if Walmart, instead of using the money dedicated to stock buybacks, which only enrich a small handful of corporate executives, instead paid their hourly employees $14.89 an hour? They would not have to raise any of their prices a single penny. The billion-dollar corporations even have the gall to tell customers already buying their stuff they should donate food to Walmart employees who make poverty wages so they can have a Thanksgiving dinner. McDonald's has gone even lower in their greedy quest for ever-increasing profits. Even though the fast food company makes $24 billion in annual revenue, which is enough money to be ranked as the world's 90th largest economy, they refuse to pay their employees a living wage. Instead, asking them to make outlandish sacrifices, McDonald's recently put up on a website encouraging their employees to cut their food into smaller portions to make it last longer, sell their Christmas gifts online to have enough money to pay bills, and then to quit complaining. Now, Tom Corbett and other governors across the United States put in office through this flooding of corporate cash into elections are obediently following their orders from their corporate benefactors. Their role is to streamline laws written by corporate lobbyists behind closed doors, that's ALEC, passed down an assembly line from posh resorts to state houses. These laws are designed to systematically bilk the poor out of the remaining scraps they cling to and redistribute them upward to the ruling class. Yes, there is redistribution of wealth in the United States, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Mark Levin, but it's in the opposite direction of what you've been claiming. These laws are also designed to strip public resources of tax dollars while enriching corporations with hefty corporate welfare packages. Yes, there's a lot of welfare in America. There's a lot of socialism in America. Let me just think for a moment. 22 banks got $16.1 trillion at zero interest. That's welfare for the wealthiest banks. Did they use that money to loan small businesses to re-stimulate the economy? No, not a dollar. Did they use that then to lower the price of the mortgage to the value of the property so people would not be underwater? Not one house. Did they use it to prevent homes from being foreclosed on? No, 7 million were foreclosed on. At least 30 million Americans made homeless. What did they do with it? Oh, they bought up competition. They engaged in derivative trading, which is now up to $606 trillion. They gave themselves massive bonuses, and they have enormous war chests, so when the Justice Department charges them a $13 billion fine, the largest in history, that's chump change. That's so easy for J.P. Morgan, Chase to pay. That's one phone call to Federal Reserve. They pay it out, and they immediately get it backed in. They reboot constantly with the stroke of a keyboard. So no amount of money do they pay will actually impact them at all. In fact, if the Justice Department says you actually caused $6 trillion in damages, so we're going to charge you $6 trillion, they would have that within 24 hours. That's how the system works. It was Senator Bernie Sanders who said 1% of the population in the U.S. owns 38% of all wealth, and 60% owns just 2.3%. 9% of Americans approve the job Congress is doing. That's proportional to the amount of people who make enormous amounts of money, about 30 million people. And just as was described in the Hunger Games, the resistance here has been met with the cold boot heel of police who only exist to protect and serve the 1% in their property. The chilling footage of the University of California Davis police pepper spraying Occupy U.S. Davis student protesters sitting peacefully and the UC Berkeley police clubbing Occupy protesters with batons, the New York City Police Department violently assaulting and mass arresting protesters and credentialed journalists, and the Oakland police turning the streets into war zones, should be, even for the most clueless, evidence that the state does not tolerate dissent. Even though the banks who bilked our economy out of trillions of dollars and got bailed out, escaped jail, are personal responsibility, our government has wasted no time throwing the book at political activists like Aaron Swartz, Barrett Brown, Jeremy Hammond. When the Reverend Billy Talon, a New York City-based environmental activist, staged a nonviolent action at a Chase Bank, he was threatened with a year in jail. But when Chase Bank rook millions of Americans out of billions of dollars, they got away with paying a paltry fine. Business as usual. And yet we're not surprised. We should be. I haven't had any people call in yet to see if they knew who wrote Land of the Docile and Unfree. It was written by H.L. Mencken in the American Credo in 1920. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I fell asleep late last night, and I dreamed that the night and almost half the day away. I just got up so that I could hear her say she's still in love, and no one could take her love away. Wakes me up every day, and I thought no one could ever make me feel this way.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. We had an incredibly positive response to the JFK 7-part series. There will be a few follow-up notes coming, from what I understand, from Robert Morningstar. Another film has been discovered that shows a different angle, that actually shows one of the shooters on the grassy knoll. And when we get that information and we can verify it, I'll put it up on our website. Also, this is from a Dr. Arden Gifford that we have not heard from before, and here's what this says. I was in the emergency room as a third-year medical student watching the events of the JFK arrival. Although I did not have any clinical responsibility, only for chiefs of service, I saw and learned directly what happened. Notice the sharp cut over the right eye of the president, about 1.5 above on forehead. A high-velocity bullet will make a small puncture wound on entry, then explode in a triangular fashion, as you see there. This is clearly obvious to any doctor seeing JFK's wound. As the pressure wave flowed through the fluid of the brain, the slowing spread it in a cone shape to blow out the back of the head on the skull, dropping the skull on the back of the car that Jackie and Secret Service tried to pick up. It sprayed blood and brain material into the mouth of the police officer at the back left of the car. The bullet came from the right front on a horizontal trajectory, had a pinpoint entry wound, and blew out horizontally the back of the skull. The bullet wound in the back was just over the thin part of the scapula, which is transparent when clean and dry and paper thin. The low-velocity bullet with downward trajectory punctured the skin in thoracic vertebrae 11, level 3, and did not have enough power to even penetrate the very thin scapula. The bullet fell on the stretcher, clean and unmarked, falling out of the skin only. Dr. Malcolm Perry did a small injection in to put a tube in the neck to get the airway. This was not the exit wound. Dr. Perry alone got JFK stable to transfer to the neuro ICU to clean the wound and examine JFK, who was not dead. He would be able to stay for weeks to months in the ICU on life support to follow a thorough management of the case. Two Secret Service agents arrived with drawn sidearms and said, "We're taking the body now." Dr. Kemp Clark, 6'4", towering figure, head of neurosurgery, was so instructed and pulled the plug, resulting in the death of JFK under the instructions from government agents. He was only given 40 minutes of immediate treatment in the PMH ER, which truly kept him alive, were it not for the government intervention. And then he goes on to talk about other things. So that person we have not heard from before, more on that as it comes up. We're trying to get him on the show, showing that the president was alive until they pulled that. By the way, as a public service, the Saving Long Island group will be showing the film Seeds of Death on Genetically Modified Organisms on December 3rd, South Huntington Public Library. And so more information on that I'll be giving you, so at least those who would like to attend and see it and help support the local group where we gave permission to show the film can certainly do so. Now to another issue. How is it that anyone from a major news outlet like MSNBC could have a whole group attend a private session with the president and not expect those of us who see their constant support of Obamacare, support of what the president's message is, not to put them in the same category as you would almost everyone, virtually everyone, over at Fox News. Just opposite side of the spectrum. And yet that's exactly what happened when Obama held an off-record meeting with MSNBC hosts, but also people from Juan Williams, that shouldn't be a surprise, Mother Jones, Think Progress, all these other places. They were all there, Ezra Pound. These are just apologists or spokespersons for this particular political ideology. Unfortunate. On Friday, there was a hacking of some sort that caused WBI's website to go down, and part of our program was not able to be heard. I'm sure that you have heard about it or read about it. All seven of our programs are fully archived on the JFK assassination. If for any reason, at any time, you dial into your local station and you can't hear it either over the internet or on a land-based station, there are several things you can do. One, you can listen over the telephone. And I keep asking over and over, write this down, because then you won't be out of the loop. All right? You'll be able to tune us in over the telephone. 619-550-0869. Also, you can download, listen live on your computer from prn.fm, tunein.com. You can also Stitcher apps, TuneIn apps, plenty of places to listen live, even if there may be some problem to a given program. Now let's go into our studio, because Valerie, our executive producer of so many of our important documentaries, is there. She's working. I'm out on the road for a short period of time, and Valerie's there. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, Gary. Nice to be here.
You want to bring us up to date on some of our socially relevant documentaries?
I certainly do. I just wanted to come on the air to let the audience know, especially all the activists out there who use our documentaries to promote social issues that they're doing really well in the film festival circuits. Today, we just won the Accolard Film Competition in La Jolla, California, for our film Silent Epidemic, The Untold Story of Vaccines. And we just began entering the festivals for Silent Epidemic and for the documentary that's just coming out, Chew on This, Dangers of the American Diet. So it's great. We've already had one for 2014. And then the last 6 months, for Seeds of Death, the unveiling the lies of GMOs, we've had 9 wins. We won the World Fest Houston competition, which is a really prestigious competition, the Special Jury Award, which is higher than their Platinum Award, for all 3 of our documentaries, Seeds of Death, War on Health, the FDA's Cult of Tyranny, and the American Veterans Discarded and Forgotten. And for Seeds of Death, we had 9 wins. We won White Sands Best Director, Breckenridge, Chicago, Urban World Festival, New York Independent Film Festival, Indie Festival, USA. For War on Health, we won the Independent Film Quarterly for the Audience Award for Best Documentary, Nevada, Fort Myers, Interbang, the Garden State Festival, the Intertendence Film Festival, and for the American Vets film, we've won the World Fest, Hoboken Best Documentary, Metropolitan Film Festival, Daytona Beach, Twin Rivers, and the New York Independent Film Festival.
Well, what it sounds like, because it just, what's important is that these documentaries serve as a call to action on important issues, environmental issues, human rights issues, health issues, and they're up on the web, they're up on our Facebook, so people can download them and share them with other people, become informed, become educated, and then become proactive. And the film festivals are just one way of showing that outside the mainstream media, which would never touch these, because we go after, you know, their sponsors and them and the politicians, there are still independent voices out there that provide forums, and that's what we appreciate. I appreciate. Thank you for sharing that with us, Val.
Congratulations, Gary.
And also for those, we have our program director, Harris Solomon. Hi, Harris.
Hi, Gary. How are you? Good to talk to you.
Good. For people who have any problem ever tuning in and finding the program, which happens because we've had intentional hacking on some of our sister stations, like BAI, where whatever their motive and whoever they are, they don't want this information out. What can people do to make sure that they always are in the loop and can hear us?
Our phone number, which is very important. If you don't have a pen and paper, get one now. That number is 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. And it operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, over the Thanksgiving holiday, over the Christmas holiday. If you can't listen on the air, if you can't listen on the website for whatever reason, just dial in that number, and you can hear the content just as it's coming out of your radio.
Good. Well, we appreciate that. That way, when people couldn't download on BAI, couldn't hear it, they didn't know what to do, we have that as a backup. And by the way, hundreds of thousands of people have listened to millions and millions and millions of minutes collectively. So that's one of our fail-safes. Thanks a lot, Harris. Now, I want to share with the audience what Ralph Nader has to say concerning the different health programs, the one in Canada and the one that is being offered currently in Obamacare. Here's what he has to say. It's 21 ways the Canadian healthcare system is better than Obamacare, as published by Common Dreams. I'll quote this. Dear America, costly complexity is baked into Obamacare. No health insurance system is without problems, but Canadian-style single-payer full Medicare, for all of its simple, affordable, and comprehensive universal quality, is preferable. In early 1960, President Lyndon Johnson enrolled 20 million elderly Americans in Medicare in 6 months. There were no websites. They did exist with index cards. Now, here are the reasons why we should look at Canada. Repeal Obamacare and replace it with the much more efficient single-payer, everybody in, nobody out, free choice of doctor and hospital. In Canada, everyone is covered automatically at birth. Everyone in, nobody out. In the United States, under Obamacare, 31 million Americans will still be uninsured, and millions more will remain underinsured. In Canada, the health system is designed to put people, not profits, first. In the United States, Obamacare will do little to curb insurance industry profits and will actually enhance insurance industry profits. In Canada, coverage is not tied to a job or dependent upon your income. Rich and poor in the same system, the best guarantee of quality. In the United States, under Obamacare, much still depends upon your job or income. Lose your job or lose your income, and you might lose your existing health insurance or have to settle for lesser coverage. In Canada, health care coverage stays with you for your entire life. In the United States, under Obamacare, for tens of millions of Americans, health care coverage stays with you for as long as you can afford your share. In Canada, you can freely choose your doctors and hospitals and keep them. There is no list of in-network vendors or no hidden charges for going out of network. In the United States, under Obamacare, the in-network list of places where you can get treated is shrinking, thus restricting freedom of choice. If you want to go out of network, you pay for it. In Canada, the healthcare system is funded by income, sales, and corporate taxes that combined are much lower than what Americans pay in premiums. In the United States, under Obamacare, for thousands of Americans, it pays, it's pay or die. If you can't pay, you die. That's why many thousands will still die every year under Obamacare from lack of health insurance to get diagnosis treated in time. In Canada, there are no complex hospital or doctor bills. In fact, usually you don't even see a bill. In the United States, under Obamacare, hospital and doctors' bills will still be terribly complex, making it impossible to discover the many costly overcharges. In Canada, costs are controlled. Canada pays just 10% of its gross domestic product for its health care system, covering everyone. In the United States, under Obamacare, costs continue to skyrocket, currently 18%, almost twice as expensive as Canada. In Canada, it is unheard of for anyone to go bankrupt due to health care costs. In the United States, under Obamacare, health care-driven bankruptcy will continue to plague us. In Canada, simplicity leads to major savings in administration costs and overhead. In the United States, under Obamacare, complexity will lead to ratcheting up of administrative costs and overhead. In Canada, when you go to a doctor or hospital, the first thing they ask is, what's wrong? In the United States, the first thing they ask is, what kind of insurance do you have? In Canada, the government negotiates drug prices so that they're more affordable. In the United States, under Obamacare, Congress made it specifically illegal for the government to negotiate drug prices for volume purchases, so they remain unaffordable. In Canada, the government health care funds are not profitably diverted to the top 1%. In the United States, under Obamacare, health care funds will continue to flow to the top. In fact, the six top CEOs of the largest insurance companies received $83.3 million in pay and benefits last year. In Canada, there are no necessary co-ops or deductibles. In the United States, under Obamacare, the deductibles and co-pays will continue to be unaffordable for millions of Americans. In Canada, the health care system contributes to social solidarity and national pride. In the United States, Obamacare is divisive, with rich and poor in different systems and tens of millions left out with limited benefits. And those are the differences that make a difference. Also, I want to give you a call to action. And that means something that impacts us, but we've not been made aware of it. The House of Representatives have looked beyond closing our national parks, stalling and environmental safeguards, and canceling research in places like Antarctica. But here's what they're scheduled to pass. Three completely wrong energy bills. Please write these down. H.R. 1900, H.R. 1965, H.R. 2728. That's again, H.R., House Representatives 1900, H.R. 1965, H.R. 2728. Why should you be opposed to these? Because these will give industry complete control over federal lands and shut down the public's voice. Worse yet, they would actually force development on precious lands in such places as Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. Even stalwart supporters of fossil fuel development should be taken aback by the reaching nature of these bills. I strongly urge the listeners in this audience to contact your local or national elected representatives to vote no on these terrible three bills for the good of the country's natural resources and to protect the right of public engagement. And I will go into greater depth about these three bills on an upcoming program, but at least you know they exist and that we should be opposed to them because they're not on our benefit. And finally, on fracking, on the environmental issue today, a wave of legislation friendly to the fracking industry in the House of Representatives is following their donations from the fossil fuel industry. A Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington report shows that the oil and gas industry contributions to congressional campaigns rose 231% in fracking states and districts. And several bills passed in Congress last week suggest these contributions paying off. In a landslide 252-165 vote, that GOP-controlled House rammed through the fracking industry H.R. 1900 on Thursday that would fast-track pipeline construction if signed into law. It follows two bills passed in the House earlier this week that I just mentioned that would make it easier to get fast permits for oil and gas drilling on federal land and roll back federal fracking regulations. So we need to understand that whoever pays money ends up getting the legislation that benefits them, but not us. So we have to become more proactive. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank those of you who've taken your time to listen today. And on Wednesday, please make a note, on Wednesday, I will finally do a full one-hour report after years of research and over 9 months of writing on this, Who Controls the World? The article, which will be posted, and my commentary, The Hidden Hand, on Wednesday. You don't want to miss that. Thank you for listening. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi, who is standing by. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, in keeping with the Hunger Games issue that you mentioned before, I have something here from a new listener. He calls himself a millennial, and he says, few of the people of my age listen, but we really ought to. He says, your comments about our strengths and weaknesses are spot on. And he says, over the weekend, my dad, who was an author, who was also a bestseller about a year ago, was talking to me about the challenges of living as a writer. And he says, what's curious to me is that you have four different books on the bestseller list, the Amazon bestseller list. I can list them. I have them right here. He says, and how do you do it? He says, don't you suffer like other writers from the idea that writing isn't a profession that could really sustain you? And he also says, the other thing that I find very curious is that you produce so many DVDs, and when you have a premiere, how do you afford to give them all out for free?
Well, this person raises several issues. First, I don't believe anyone should go into the area of writing as if they were going to be able to sustain themselves on it, because very few people have or could. You have to be extremely fortunate to have the material people want to read, whether it's a novel or a book. But for most people writing today, and some of the wisest people in the world, some of the greatest minds writing today, they don't get any advance for their books. They might sell 1,000, 2,000 copies if they're lucky. And so no one, that's not a job. That's just a hobby that stimulates them that they feel they need to release. I do believe, however, that as the world has changed, publishing online will become more popular. And that's something people can do and market and therefore keep the benefits of. Right now, from the time you finish a manuscript, it may take a clear year before you see the book into the marketplace. And then it's only for about 8 weeks. There's a very short lifespan on books going into the marketplace because there's so many trying to get in there and so few outlets to share with them. And if you don't have a national tour and a major publicity campaign, your book comes and goes and is forgotten. If you publish online and if you put your energy and some resources behind social media marketing, you have a chance of getting your message out. But even then, there's 10 times more information put out onto the internet than there is in bookstores. So you're still with a lot of competition. You just have to be wise and ask yourself, who do I want this material to be read by? And do I really need a financial remuneration to do it? I believe that for anyone, myself included, where our principle is not making money, our principle is to sharing a message, then align yourself with people who would benefit from that message. And that should be your reward. If you happen to get paid some money in the process, fine. With documentaries, you lose money. Unless you're Michael Moore, everyone else loses money. Of the 10,000 documentaries and independent films done each year, they all lose money. They don't make a nickel. And but you have to do them for a reason other than making money. You have to do them because you feel it's important to expressing an energy towards an injustice. And that's why I do them. And that's why most people I know do them. But that documentaries are extremely powerful tools for social change. And the network is, the internet is the future of empowering, informing, and educating people on progressive issues. And that's why I believe that all those documentaries can find a home on the internet. We just have to make sure that we're aware of those documentaries and go to the internet for them. Hope that answers this question. No, I don't know anyone personally that can say that they make a good living writing books. There's just too little money. It takes too long a time. There's a great deal of corruption, and the poor author gets stuck. It's the exception you hear about, not the rule. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
Let's say hello to Eutrice. Hi, Eutrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about three things. About a report, that scathing report, that says that Detroit is exaggerating its debts in order to hasten bankruptcy. We're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And we're talking about the Scottsboro Nine and the Central Park Five.
Great. We look forward to it right now.
Thank you.
Call me, call me, call me. What a beautiful time.